Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 79 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. In the Middle Ages, pretty much everything that was created took time, effort, and expertise, which means that there weren't too many objects that were created without careful thinking involved. From manuscripts to wash basins, medieval objects can tell us a lot about how people conceived of the world and of themselves. Enter Dr. Jack Hartnell. Jack is a lecturer of art history at the University of East Anglia and the author of Medieval Bodies, Life and Death in the Middle Ages. When I was looking up Jack's bio to find out more about what I should tell you about him, I found this sentence, which I think phrases it better than I could. His research treats objects as intricate puzzles that can be slowly unraveled layer by layer to tell us all sorts of things about the world at the time of their creation, from grand political structures or religious narratives to the more mundane and distinctly human details of everyday life in the past. And that, my friends, is exactly what he and I talked about this week. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Jack about medieval art, medieval bodies, and what we can learn about the past through objects. Well, thanks, Jack, for joining me to talk about your book, Medieval Bodies. And I'm just so happy to have you on the show. So welcome, first of all.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Great to chat.
And I want to congratulate you on the book because I read a lot of books for this job and not all of them are super enjoyable. And this one was just so readable and really welcoming, I think, people to the community. So congratulations. It's a great book.
Well, thank you very much. That's really nice to hear.
It's all true. I tell no lies on this podcast. So we were just talking, and this is one of the many books that has two alternate titles. So one version of the title is Medieval Bodies, Life and Death in the Middle Ages. And the other title is Medieval Bodies, Life, Death and Art in the Middle Ages. So what's the difference between the titles and what does it mean? What does it mean?
There's no difference between the books, I should say. So one is just the original book, which was published first in the UK, Medieval Bodies, Life, Death and Art in the Middle Ages. But the American publishers, for reasons that I'm not entirely sure, I totally trust them to know their audience. I think maybe they had a kind of interested history dad in mind when they were pitching, thinking about who might want to read it.
History dad, that's a good category,
history
dad, I think.
Books, right, basically it's like books of tanks and books of, yeah, but so I'm glad that they think history dads are interested in medieval art and medieval medicine. But they felt that there was something about the word art that might be off-putting to the history dad. I hope I'm representing their opinion appropriately, and I think that's how they communicated it to me. So they just went with life and death in the Middle Ages, which is pithy in its own way. But as an art historian, it was kind of slightly horrifying that art, you know, this kind of a whole kind of branch of culture, which I tend to focus on and which many of my colleagues also write amazing stuff about, was a turnoff for the history dad. So that's really interesting to hear. Anyway, so they changed it and they changed the cover as well. But interestingly, so it's been translated into a few other languages. And as far as I can tell, its art is been kept, art's still there in the Italian version, and there's a Japanese and a Chinese and a Taiwanese version, interestingly, coming out. I don't quite know what the titles are yet because they haven't come out, but the Russian version wins the award for the strangest title. I showed it to my in-laws, actually, who both fluent Russian speakers, and I said, oh, here's the book, and they're like, okay. And I said, it says Medieval Bodies, right? And they're like, sort of. It says the Naked Middle Ages. I think the impression is the Middle Ages sort of laid bare, so to speak. A great pun. Perfectly happy with good puns. But it was quite interesting that it was down as the Naked Middle Ages. So that's what it is for any Russian speakers out there.
Yeah.
Let me know more. I'd be very grateful.
And that's exactly what you want to present to your in-laws, right?
Exactly. Right. Hi, guys. I've written some historical pornography.
But coming back to the book.
it's just interesting that clearly different audiences want to get different things from, I mean, the contents are the same. What's really great is in the different foreign language versions, they have added, often the translators, who I'm told by native speakers have done really great jobs, have added in often footnotes, which the book itself doesn't have. which just give you a little bit more information on things that maybe we in an Anglophone audience take for granted. Certain references that I make to, I don't know, Game of Thrones, or it's just the first one I think of in the beginning, or I don't know, telling people a little bit more about who Thomas Aquinas was, or some certain kind of mainstays of intellectual history and popular culture, which become footnotes in these foreign versions. It's really interesting to kind of put them all together, for me at least, and to see what different audiences in different places already know about the Middle Ages, what they need some kind of further education on, and hopefully it all comes together in the end.
Yeah, that's really, it's interesting feedback to get, and it's not something you expect to get feedback from translators that tells you, you know, the shape of the book, how it might be different or how it might land, but it makes a whole lot of sense. Coming back to the art thing, this is an art book, even if it's incognito, because a lot of the ways that you get at medieval bodies, they start with art, and it makes it a beautiful book. But why do you start with art when you're getting at medieval bodies?
Well, it partly comes from my research. So the book actually really sort of began life as a course that I teach at the University of East Anglia in Norwich in the UK, where I teach. And I teach in a department of art history and world art studies. So I guess I'm a big advocate of art history as a discipline. It's often seen by straight up historians as what you might call history minus, that we're just looking at objects and it's somehow a closed minded history. But I couldn't see that as further from the truth. For me, it's very much history plus. That is to say, what we're doing is history. For me, I don't teach the history of art, rather art history. That is to say, I look at history, in this case, history of the Middle Ages and the history of medicine in the Middle Ages, through artworks, objects. Art, even the term art, maybe the reason that it was so off-putting for the American publishers is it sort of brings with it, doesn't it, a slightly highfalutin, snooty art world, which obviously, you know, medieval objects have very little to do with. Really, what I'm interested in is material culture and visual culture. So everything from expensive, highly artistic commissioned artworks by professional artists through to objects of medieval medicine that were used by people every day, pots for keeping medicines in. I talk a little bit about medical instruments, but also think much more broadly. So just to pull some out the top of my head, we talk in the book a little bit about jewelry, or a little bit about clothing, or a little bit about manuscript culture. So it really, you know, art is a great way of pulling together different kinds of histories, and especially histories of different kinds of people. The history of art is often seen as quite an elitist history, not just in how it's written now, but who it is written about. We think about artists working in court culture and working for, you know, kings and queens of medieval Europe, especially in a European context. It can seem like what you're writing is a very elite history, just in the same way, in some ways, as the history of literature or the history of certain kinds of historical record, our history of literate people. What's really nice about material culture, especially some of the more nitty-gritty quotidian things, maybe things found in more archaeological contexts, not stuff that's in art museums, but in museums of history, is that you get access to a whole other group of people that are often impossible to find in the written record, or at least very difficult to intuit, whether that's different in medical context, different kinds of healers who are, you know, not part of that literate world, or just generally histories of women, histories of minorities, histories of people who are simply not kings and queens or ruling classes. So it gives us access, I think, looking, or at least introducing ideas through objects, gives us access to all sorts of different kinds of histories that we might not otherwise think about.
Yeah, and that's exactly the word that I was thinking about, is access, where I think, you know, having maybe the word art in the title makes it seem inaccessible. And first of all, this book is extremely accessible. It's easy to read. But also the material objects that you've picked out are ways through which people accessed their worlds at the time. So they're very practical is not the word I want, but they're objects through which people are accessing their worldview. And that's kind of where you start, I think, each section to really kind of explain how people are thinking about the body and how they're conceptualizing it, right?
Absolutely. And what I've tried to do, I guess, a little bit as well, is to splice that art historical approach with some of the amazing things that historians of medicine of the medieval period, especially medieval Europe and the Middle East and North Africa, which is where the book focuses, what some amazing historians of medicine have done, in unpicking histories of healers and healing. So, for instance, the structure of the book runs like a medieval medical treatise, or certain kinds of medieval medical treatises would have done, especially things like 14th century physicians' treatises, run from really from head to toe, right? Acapite ad calcem is the Latin says, right, from head to heel. So, you know, if you opened up a many 14th century, I'm just choosing 14th century as an example, 14th century French or English medical books, they're structured like a human body. So I thought, you know, what better way to structure this book than to follow the lead of those healers? And so it begins with the head, runs through different body parts and a kind of bodily structures. So there's a one on bone and skin and blood as well. So it's not just kind of individual organs, down to the feet. So what I was trying to do there is to sort of hybridize approaches, because I think it's a big buzzword at the moment in the history of the history generally, interdisciplinarity, this idea that we're pulling together different, not just different objects or ideas from different fields, but different methods as well. And I think they complement each other really nicely, actually, because although it's not, you know, so much of medieval medical culture in a European and Middle Eastern context is something that maybe is best or at least understood in its specifics through texts. Not a lot of medieval medical texts, or certainly the minority are illustrated texts. But those that are illustrated, I think, give us a really interesting angle on new and different things.
Yeah. And I think that it's a good approach to take, the interdisciplinary approach, because people thought of many things in terms of the body. So not just medical stuff in terms of the body, but how you map things, how politics worked, you know, the body politic, you know, these people mm-hmm. are the hands, these people are the head. So having this work all layers upon layers to do with the body, I think really works in the medieval conceptualization of the world. Yeah, this really works. Okay, so you've covered a whole bunch of things. So I'll just list them so people can get an idea. You talk about the head, you talk about senses, which I think is a nice one to not forget, because people do think in terms of senses, even if they're not discrete parts of the body per se. Skin, bone, heart, blood, hands, stomach, genitals, of course, everyone's favorite chapter, feet, and then future bodies. So what were some of the chapters that you were working on that you really felt engaged with or wanted to work more on? Had like really, they lit up your brain, you wanted to learn more about them.
Well, this, just thinking of the senses, for instance, I mean, that it's obvious to say that each of these chapters could be an entire book in themselves. There's so much material there, covering a huge, trying to marshal together something from a huge period of time, many different cultures, many different religions, many different places as well. But probably the one where that was maybe the hardest was the chapter on the senses. I ummed and ahed about senses, because in a way it kind of breaks from the technically kind of body part structure. But then a chapter that was called, you know, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and touch, I don't know, it just didn't work. And that's what's really interesting about the senses. They are, as historians of kind of the senses and sensation and emotion as well, speak about this really interesting phrase of sensory archaeology, that actually piecing together people's understanding of their own senses in the past, and also trying to, in a sense, project yourself back into a historical moment and see what people saw or feel what people felt or hear what people heard, is a virtually impossible task, because what we're bringing is the subjectivity of modern understanding and imposing on the past, you know, what a historian of medicine would call a retrospective diagnosis, right? A historical diagnosis, not a good thing, or at least a complicated thing. So that, for me, in terms of marshalling these together, was probably one of the tougher chapters to write, and yet one of the richer ones. I mean, when you do come across individuals who write about their senses or who are objects, I'm reminded of a section in the book where I talk about two objects, both from around 1200, two censers. So these are beautifully crafted metal, sort of pierced metal and cast metal objects, one of which is from Italy and would have included, would have had incense inside. It's kind of like this amazing, almost mini micro architectural, almost little chapel on chains, which would have been swung during the mass in a Christian church service, and scent would have come out of it. Scent, which is a really important part of the Christian mass in lots of quite complicated and interesting ways, that people who are interested in liturgy have written about very interestingly. And I was took that and paired it with this really much smaller, similar object, but from the Islamic world, probably made in Syria, a circular gimbal or a circular kind of pierced, decorated metal ball, which inside has a little gimbal, which meant that you could put a bit of incense in. And no matter which way you rolled the ball, the incense would always remain upright. So it's something that this little sort of incensing object that you could pass around along the floor of a kind of makeshift tent when you're en route somewhere, or you just, they're both very evocative objects in their own way. They've got this really interesting imagery. One looks like a mini church. The other has images of the seven planets as they were understood in the Middle Ages, personifications around them. So they've got lots of imagery on them. But almost what's more interesting is having them as a material record of, on the one hand, church practice, on the other hand, maybe more courtly practice or everyday practice in different parts of the world, both associated with the same scent. So you can, even just with those two, you can see all sorts of connections that are made, but also they give you really interesting access again onto thinking about past senses.
Yeah, those are good objects to include in here, because so often when we look back to art of the Middle Ages or we're trying to access how people felt, if it's not in the written record, we're looking at two-dimensional paintings often, and we're looking at manuscript images, and that only gives you part of the story, right? You have to kind of extrapolate what's going on in the scene and try and figure things out, where you have a three-dimensional object like these sensors that you have, and you try and think about how they were used in practical in everyday life, and it really does give you, well, a fuller picture of what things might have been like.
Mm. And I think what you're talking about there are sort of two layers of art history, both of which can be really rich, but have to be considered together. So the first stage we would think of as quite a simple iconography, whether you're looking at a, say, a page of a manuscript with a particular saint, and you know it's a saint who, I don't know, is getting his head chopped off, and you know it's a French manuscript. So you can do a little bit of digging and work out, oh, this is an image of Saint-Denis, right, who was decapitated and who's miraculously stood up and walked with his head to a particular site. And that's where the church of then Cathedral of Saint-Denis was founded, just north of Paris. It became a very famous church in which the kings of France were interred. So you can do a very simple what it is. But maybe more interesting is to think, well, hang on a second, you know, why is this, or rather, how is this object being used? So a kind of more material, visual, contextual analysis of this object. What we, I think, what from the sort of 60s and 70s onwards has been understood as sometimes called the new art history, but really the term we often use now is the social history of art. This is an understanding of art, not just as a catalogue of different types, but actually these are active agents out there in the world. So who owned that book with the image of Saint-Denis? You know, you even got some really interesting historians like Catherine Rudy, who teaches at the University of St. Andrews, who goes around with a machine she's put together called a densitometer. And she actually looks at the different pages, the corners of the pages of these things, and works out from the kind of darkness and evidence of human touch on these books, which are perhaps, can't tell whether it's medieval or post-medieval or a combination, but which were the pages which were turned to the most. You know, so we have a book that we know was used during the Middle Ages, and then maybe for various reasons of provenance, not used again for a long, long time. Well, we actually have some evidence, perhaps, from the way that these, I don't know, she looks, for instance, at images that have been kissed a lot or touched a lot because their paint is smeared. So it becomes less about the specifics of the iconography of what we're seeing, and actually tells you way more about how objects use, and in a sense, a more emotional, affective function for that object in the past. Yeah. And so we've got to do both of those things at the same time. Otherwise, you're just kind of, it's just a kind of long typological line of kind of spot the trope, which is not really very interesting. Or it can be, but it doesn't tell you very much about the contextual use of these objects.
Yeah, well, even manuscripts, as you're implying here, they are meant to be touched and used and worked with and things like that. So you have things that are built into a manuscript that are meant for devotion. You're meant to kiss the page, or you have an example in this section on blood, I think, where you're meant to count the wounds, and there is a devotional practice. You're meant to count Christ's wounds. So you're actually meant to touch this page, not just look mm-hmm. at it and interact with mm-hmm. it. So it's important to think of these things, especially with manuscripts. We so often think of them, I think you do a Google image search, right? And it just seems so two-dimensional. But to see the actual manuscript, you have a better understanding of how it's actually used. And I think you do explain that really well in the book as well.
Yeah, I mean, with manuscripts, and you can take it to the extremes. I mean, it's not just that these are physical things, pages that are turned, but it's also, you know, the touch of the parchment. Parchment, you know, for anyone who hasn't ever had an opportunity to, who's listening, to go and actually kind of turn the pages of a medieval manuscript, you would be surprised the amount of kind of, if you have a big library near you, perhaps in a capital city, wherever you are, these things are often part of national collections that you can just order up, go and leaf through yourself. And I cannot encourage you to do that more. Because, you know, the touch of parchment is nothing like paper. Often you can feel the hair of the, of the parchment on one side or the other. It's got a kind of crinkliness, stiffness, almost like a kind of strange plastic to it, rather than a kind of softness of the page. It crinkles, right? You can think of the sound of the manuscript. They smell, and not unpleasant, right? But there's a scent, there's a kind of organic quality to them, just like when you open up a brand new published modern book, there's that kind of sharp, slightly acidic new book smell which people kind of crave, right? These are deeply sensory objects, and they were understood as such in the past as well. And this were just us in our modern sensory kind of overstimulated world projecting backwards, I would maybe be less interested. But medieval writers, medieval artists always play with this. So for instance, think of a medieval bestiary, a kind of gathering together of often from the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, of a kind of narratives of lots of different animals. So it tells you a little bit about the supposed history as it was understood way back to the classical world of different kinds of animals, both real and slightly fantastical, understood to be fantastical as well. Not that medieval people walking around thinking, you know, that necessarily unicorns existed, but they're really interesting cultural objects, so they're included in these bestiaries. And often the pages of these parchment pages of these bestiaries, so parchment made from animal skin, writings about animals, there are all sorts of really interesting connections made. So sometimes the authors will leave gaps, or artists will use holes in the page, which are of course holes in the animal's skin originally, to emphasize certain, I don't know, details, or to decorate them, or to stitch them up in really interesting ways. So you know, the artists and writers of the period were using and perfectly, you know, thinking about the animal nature of the page when they were writing about animals. And that's just one example of many. The medieval artisans and writers were extremely aware of the multisensory nature of what they were creating, what they were doing.
Yeah. And I think, as you were saying earlier, that each of these chapters could be an entire book. There's so much going on. And you've brought in things from just different parts of social history as well. It's not just medicine. It's not just bodies. So it tells you a lot about the medieval world. But the one chapter where I felt like, you just as a writer, I felt like you might have had to rein it in because it could have gone just forever, was the one on hands, where you have a piece of a wax tablet that has an image of game. We can talk about people are playing this game. But then, you know, as the chapter goes on, you're saying, and then there's this layer, and then there's this layer, and this layer. The tactile one, I think it was a particularly rich chapter. And I don't know if it felt like that when you're writing it, but it felt like an exciting chapter because there's always so much more you could add to it.
Yeah, I mean, that one actually was quite tough because it, in a sense, is such a huge topic. I guess one of the things that you worry about when you write any kind of book, especially one that's, in theory, introducing a whole kind of body of scholarship with which people have worked on for years and years to a different kind of audience, which I guess was one of my goals here. I think the anxiety is that you kind of end up getting so excited and kind of throwing in so many different ideas from all sorts of places that what you end up with is this slightly flat, very broad, and maybe slightly bland thing. And I think that probably the hardest, when I felt that possibility the most, was in the hands chapter for sure. Because, you know, everything's touched and touches everything in a sense. You know, I think I begin by talking to this really interesting historian of the medieval senses, Chris Woolgar, who writes about how Aristotle, whose thinking informed a lot of medieval understanding of the senses, talks about touch as being, on the one hand, the basest sense, right? It doesn't have that kind of ethereal quality of something like smell, or the heavenly implications of something like sound, or indeed the kind of immediacy and importance of something like vision. Touch is base and simple, right? You have to be in physical contact with the thing you're touching. You can't just have a scent drifting on the waves in a way that's not entirely understandable or perceptible. Yet on the other hand, Aristotle says, touch is the one sensation that really defines fundamentals of life. That's to say, human beings can function, this is I'm sure medically not technically true, but he's talking in a philosophical sense, can function without sight, without smell, without taste, without hearing, but without touch, we would be utterly adrift in the world. Basically, we would, he says, you know, effectively, we would be dead. So already then, just in that single sort of sensation, you're dealing with the least interesting sense and the most important sense at the same time, even by medieval kind of standards of medieval philosophy and theology.
No pressure.
no pressure, exactly. But what's, you know, so one of the ways, again, for me, maybe that's just part of how I think, but one of the easiest ways into thinking about this is through the implications of this are through objects. So the tablet that you spoke about just before was a very, very small carved ivory tablet, probably smaller than an iPhone, I would say, probably only a few inches wide by a few inches tall, probably originally formed, we can tell from a groove on the back of it, a part of a pear which folded like a little booklet and which would have had inside them a thin layer on the flat inside, a thin layer of wax into which people could inscribe, basically like a little notebook, like a medieval etcher sketch. You run it over a flame, the wax would flatten and reset itself, you could write again. And on the front of this half of the tablet, we have this really interesting, very crammed, dense, decorated scene carved in very, very thin relief. This is why ivory was such a prized tool for medieval carvers. Again, you know, we could go off and talk about the history of ivory and its importation from Africa. But what's really interesting is that, you know, it's very soft in the way that it can be carved. So you can get real detail and it sort of takes the detail. If you were trying to do the same thing in stone would snap, it's too brittle and break. It's a very carefully carved image. But the scene, you know, it's an expensive object. Ivory, it's come all, you know, it's from an elephant tusk that's been imported all the way from Africa. You know, we'd expect it to be this extremely highfalutin, wonderful, important kind of object. And indeed, we get many ivory diptychs with religious scenes, beautifully carved, extremely expensive objects. This one, though, has a scene of a, I guess we might call it a little courtly game called La Main Chaude, like the hot hand. And it's basically a game where titillating game where men and women of the court will basically be blindfolded. In this case, one of the figures is being blindfolded by having his head covered by a woman's skirt, so his head's basically up her skirt, and you would be spanked, the person who's blindfolded, and you had to guess who spanked you, basically. It's not rocket science of the game. But it's kind of this slightly strange version of Duck Duck Goose, I guess, in a medieval kinky context. But you know, it's designed and thought of as this fun kind of strange courtly game. But the way it's presented on this little object, everyone has these giant hands, not crazy giant, but just enlarged with these elegant long fingers. And the more you look at it, you realize that there are hands everywhere. And this is a game all about spanking, all about hitting, all about touch, right? But it's also an object that is held in the hand. It's tiny. It's all about writing. It's all about the touch of the pen or the stylus on the wax. So you have all these ramifications bouncing backwards and forwards in the image of something that was touched and used all the time and for which it was thought appropriate to have an image of touch or a kind of playful game, which is all about the touch and the hand. And so you get this kind of really interesting feedback loop, which is something that I'm sure the medieval artisan who made it was well aware of, or the person who commissioned it, it was specifically commissioned. This is a thing that's all about touch, both in how it was used. It's a little bit like, to go back to what we were saying before, the iconography of the image and the social history of the image coming together. It's a kind of iconography of touch and a social history of touch. And the more and more you kind of as you go through, in particular, the history of touch and touch and kind of as a sense in the Middle Ages, you can find lots of objects and texts and ideas that play with that, showing something being touched in an object that itself was all about opening up or touching or kind of caressing in an interesting way.
Yeah, and I think that's important to point out. You mentioned in your section on digestion, where you have people assume that medieval humor is pretty base and pretty basic, but you point out that it's sophisticated in a lot of ways that we might not recognize immediately because that's not our culture. And I think it's worth recognizing that the games that people played with, the images that they made or the objects that they made would be sophisticated. That, you know, it wasn't simple. It wasn't just a pipe, you know, that they're making. Yeah.
Yeah, I think humor is, you know, he's talking about sensory archaeology and the difficulty of unpicking, you know, how people understood the senses in the past. Well, the history of humor is even more impossible, right? Firstly, because as soon as you explain a joke, it ceases to be funny, right? I mean, can you imagine if someone took a, like, think of the most hilarious joke you've heard of the last week, some witticism on Twitter or something, and imagine just trying to explain it with its constituent parts to someone who didn't understand maybe the very specific context that you've met, you know, that happened to come together, if you find it funny, and instantly the thing is unfunny already. And that's even with things that people might be able to be explained and have understood. Right now, I don't know, take even a joke from, I don't know, 20 years ago. Think of a political cartoon of George Bush, for instance. Right. I mean, firstly, you're showing to someone who'd never seen, who didn't understand who he was or what the context was. Probably even someone who was in the UK who was alive at that time, like myself, I would be like, I don't quite get this. I mean, I get it looks like a funny image of George Bush, but why is he doing whatever he's doing? So, you know, these are things that translate extremely poorly. But, you know, there are a few that do still appeal to our sense of humor. In the section on the digestion, I'm thinking there are certain kind of, I guess, universals of bodily humor, toilet humor, sexual humor, which are things that are, you know, in some ways, maybe actually humor about the body in the past is slightly more accessible to us because we still have bodies, and that's one interesting constant there. There's a lot of medieval art and literature and writing of all kinds, which is definitely intended to be humorous and that we are just missing the joke on, I think.
It's like when high school kids are reading Shakespeare or something and they have no idea what all the layers on that art, and you get to a certain level and you start to read that again, and it makes complete sense in a way that it didn't make sense before. But yeah, I think that we need to give people credit for sophistication in humor and in objects as well. So is there a favorite object that you have in this book? I mean, the way you describe these objects and list them, like, these seem like some of your favorite things that you've actually picked up and worked with. And it's funny, it's only a couple sentences, but I can feel the love for these objects in the book.
Oh, I'm glad, yeah. I think, well, is it my favorite? I don't know. But there's one which is illustrated in the chapter on blood, which I talk about very briefly, which is actually the subject of a book I'm writing at the moment, a more academic book. It's a diagram from the history of surgery, I guess we would say, that emerges in the 15th century. It's known to modern historians as the wound man. It's basically an image of a man. I'm flicking to the page here and looking at it now so I can describe it to you. A man who's standing with sort of arms wide apart. He's naked apart from this rather strange pair of blue underpants. And he is covered from head to toe in a litany of unpleasant bruises, cuts, lesions. He's being stabbed and hit by a variety of clubs and swords and as a knife, as a bunch of spears and arrows snapped off in him at different points. He's got a spider crawling up his thigh. There's a toad in his stomach. He seems to have all these lumps, these kind of goiters under his armpits and his neck that suggests maybe he's contracted plague. There's a dog, a rabid dog biting his ankle. He's trodden on a nail.
So it's a picture of 2020, right?
it's like 2020 for some time. Exactly. You know, and this is an image which no one's really kind of thought about in a sustained way in the history of medicine or really in the history of art. And it's really interesting coming together of the two. Because, you know, this isn't just an image of like a deeply unlucky, unpleasant demise of someone. His eyes are open, right? He's alive. His eyes are bloodshot, but he is alive and he seems kind of miraculously so. But if you look a little more closely at the image, each of those different injuries around his body has a little bit of text. In this case, it's from a German manuscript made in Bavaria. So it's in German, in kind of form of Middle High German in a Southern German dialect. And each of these little things say things like, when a spider bites, or when stabbed by a sword, or when a club hits the head. And there's a little number after. And on the following pages, actually, are a series of surgical instructions, about 42, 43 in all, which give medieval or offer a medieval surgeon in quite simple, quite clear language, a number of different potential treatments for all of these different problems. So how to put together some anti-venom or medieval equivalent of it for a spider bite, or how to dress a wound, or how to make sure a wound isn't dirty and to clean it before you dress it, how to stitch up a wound, how to make an anti-hemorrhagic powder, styptic powder, or a red Hautpulver, a red powder, as it's known in German, which is just basically putting together different kinds of, both medically but also slightly superstitiously, we would today say superstitiously, valent objects in order to stop the figure bleeding, how to remove the nail, and so on and so forth. So it's a really interesting diagram, I guess we could say, which outlines all of these different medieval cures. And what's particularly interesting for me, as I said, I'm writing this book about it at the moment, is that it's an image that is born during the Middle Ages, attached to a lot of medical surgical books. I have probably about 10, 15 of them in medieval manuscripts from the 15th century, mainly in Germany, in Bohemia, or modern-day Czech Republic. But it's an image that also gets reproduced in very early printed medical books. So in Venice in the year 1490, it moves into 1491, moves into print, and from there it gets exported all around the world. So you have really interesting examples of it across Europe and through into the 16th century, 17th century. There's even some images from it that appear in 18th century Japanese medical scrolls, these big long scrolls, and which are all sort of seem to represent the trading relationship between Dutch traders and the Japanese in the 18th century, where there's some degree of medical exchange. So this is, again, coming back to this idea of iconography and social context, right? We follow this one image, but it's not really a book. It's not going to be a book about how this image stays the same, but rather how different cultures over time turn to this image to tell them different things about the practice of surgery, about the practice of image making. So that's what I've been thinking a lot about.
No, it's an image that I think people come across often, fairly often, and maybe don't understand that it is an explanatory image. It's not just, you know, to show how much people loved torture, because I think that, yeah, you know, it's a very common myth, but actually it shows healing. And that's mm-hmm. kind of an interesting thing to have, you know, all these wounds are here because it's meant to be showing healings. It's an interesting image. So you're working on this book right now?
Yeah, that's the plan, at least. It's obviously, I think it's tough for anyone who's working with objects at the moment, because, you know, so many libraries around the world are shut. So all of these, it's good to hear that in some places they're starting to open up again. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles at the moment, where I am for research, and there's nothing open here at the moment. So for all the amazing things that, you know, digital collections can offer people in this time of isolation and lockdown, actually it's I think tough for those who, as I said, you know, we were saying earlier, think about manuscripts in which all of these images of the womb man are, they're really sensory things, and to get a good sense of them and to be able to write about them, I think convincingly you've got to hold them in your hands.
Well, I mean, nothing's really ideal this year anyway. But but for people who want to get an entry into the medieval world through objects, through art, you have great pictures in your book, so they can come back to you.
Hey, there you go. Great.
Good See plug. How I did that?
Good plug. No, very nice. Yeah. You're a pro.
This is not my first rodeo. But I want to thank you for coming on the podcast to talk about the book, because as I said, I mean, I don't gush about books unless I really like them. And I do think this is a really good book for, you can get for your history dad at Christmas, you know, it'll tell you a lot about the medieval world, and I think get people interested in learning more about it. So thank you for coming on the podcast to talk about it. And thank you for writing this book.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to chat.
Jack's book is called Medieval Bodies, Life and Death in the Middle Ages, and it's available at pretty much every bookstore out there. You can find out more about him and his work on his website, jackhartnell.com. That's Jack, HARTNELL.com. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, we have the fourth and final part of our series on Robin Hood. So find out who exactly was Robin Hood. You may find that out in this final part. You can also read about the rise and fall of the Icelandic Commonwealth. What kind of schooling did medieval peasants get? And we also report on the largest study of Viking genetics that has ever been done.
Yeah, I need to read about that. I haven't actually dug into that, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. It's, they've been doing a lot of work over the last few years or so. And it's interesting to find out, the connections within Scandinavia and outside. So we got a lot of fun on that.
Yeah, and I already know who Robin Hood is. He's a fox, right? Spoiler alert.
Yeah, right. He spoiled it for all listeners.
You should still read the article, though.
Hey, by the way, the next map that Tina Ross is going to be doing for our Maps of the Medieval World series is going to be 14th century London.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's somehow I had a little influence on her picking that one. So.
Yeah, just a little. That's going to be great. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for supporting this podcast and allowing me to share the medieval past with you every week. As Peter said, one of the great rewards you can get as a patron is a brand new and exclusive map by Tina Ross every month. But we also have great deals on all your favorite medieval magazines, including Medieval Warfare and the Medieval Magazine. We even have a book club. But even if you only have a dollar to put in the tip jar, rest assured that we love you just the same. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. For art objects to Robin Hood, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Cebulski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.